It's that time again. Hi, listeners. This week's episode of Sex Gets Real is hysterical. I'm so excited to bring it to you. And I just want to remind you, it's been amazing hearing so many of your voices call in and leaving voicemails to be part of the new intro that I'm creating for the podcast. If you want to get your voice to me so that you can possibly be part of the new intro I'm creating for the show, all you have to do is, if you're in the US or Canada, call 747-444-1840 from a nice quiet location and leave a message saying you're listening to Sex Gets Real with Dawn Sarah. If you're outside one of those two countries and you still want to participate, I've been getting emails from people, which is amazing. So you can record yourself saying that same phrase, download the MP3, and then email it to info@sexgetsreal.com. I also want to invite you to go to sexgetsreal.com and just make sure you're part of the newsletter. I've got a couple of workshops that I'm going to be taking online, plus some free talks that I'm going to be giving in the next couple of months. So to get notified about the free talks and some of the workshops that are going to be really awesome, I mean like next level stuff, then make sure you're on the newsletter for sexgetsreal.com. I think now it's time to jump in to this really funny episode with Kate Lister from Whores of Yore. Hey everyone, Dawn Sarah here with Sex Gets Real, and this week joining me on the show is Kate Lister. Welcome to the show, Kate.
Hi, Dawn. It's lovely to be with you. Thank you.
So you run the Whores of Yore Twitter and Instagram, which is one of my favorite accounts in the entire universe.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah, and for those of you who don't know Kate, Kate is a university lecturer, a researcher of the history of sexuality, a horror historian at the University of Perversity, a cake connoisseur, and the owner of Whores of Yore. So I love that, horror historian at the University of Perversity. What an amazing title.
That's not my official title.
No, but even as a self-selected
one. It works really well, doesn't it? It always breaks the ice at Christmas parties anyway.
I hope that you have cards that say that.
I do. Absolutely, I do. Yeah.
Good.
The one thing that I've learned since having the feed is that I have to be very careful with the use of the word whore now.
Mm.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Because when I first started using it, it was because it rhymed very conveniently with your. And seeing as I wanted to tweet about the history of sex work and sexuality, it just seemed to go together so nicely. But there's a whole process of reclamation around that word for sex workers, and they can get very defensive when non-sex workers use it, and I feel that I'm forever needing to define what I mean by it, and you can get into trouble with it real quick.
Yeah, I noticed that the pinned tweet on Whores of Yore is an attempt to explain the usage and your intent behind the word whore.
That was because a sex work campaigner who did a TED talk, Tony Mack, she is a campaigner at the Sex Worker Open University, and she got hold of me and said that some people within the sex work community were having an issue with me using that word. They felt that it was derogatory. They felt that it was adding to stigma instead of dismantling it. So I felt that, well, I like the sound bite. I like Whores of Yore, but I need to clarify what I mean by that. And what I mean by that is, just from a historical point of view, is that word, whore, has been levied at any woman, really. Let's be honest. I mean, now we talk about man whores, but it really means a woman. It's been leveled at any woman who's transgressed sexual boundaries or has just been more confident and more outspoken and stood her ground more than most people. I mean, Joan of Arc was called a whore and she died a virgin. So that was sort of one of the things that I wanted to get across, was that it's not necessarily a stigmatizing or derogatory word, or it doesn't have to be. It's a defiant word.
Yeah, it's a word that as I've become more familiar with sex worker rights, sex worker issues, the discrimination against sex workers, it's a word that I've phased out of my own vocabulary just because I felt like that's not a space where I should be using the word at this time. Yeah. But I think it's such a powerful word and a powerful conversation to have, because then we get to talk about all of these things and how we vilify the sexuality of women throughout time.
Well, whore is a really, really old word. I mean, it's really old. Even its origins are just lost in the midst of time somewhere. But it's always been there, and it's always been a term that's been used to stigmatize and abuse women, and not just sex workers, women just having sex. They were regularly called whores and all kinds of words. And that's how I was using it, because I wanted it to be a history of illicit sex. But I am now very sensitive to the fact and very careful when that I only really use it in the handle. And that when I'm tweeting and how I'm expressing myself otherwise, it's not my word to use in other contexts, if that makes sense. But yeah, I think understanding the history of stigmatizing sex and especially female sexuality is very important.
So for those of our listeners who don't know what your Twitter and Instagram are all about, can you give us an idea of kind of how it got started and what it's become? Because you're now up to almost 55,000 followers, and it's been around for about a year, right?
Just under a year. Yeah, I started it, I think it was around about last November, December time, I think. So, I researched the history of sexuality and gender and in sort of literature and those kind of things at the University of Leeds Trinity in the UK. And I just kept finding all these really interesting facts and figures and like there was so much personal history there, you know, like just little history, little people's history, just people that weren't on the radar that just crop up occasionally. And they were always the ones that interested me the most. I mean, it's great that King, whoever, was doing this, that, and whatever, but what were people doing for birth control in the Middle Ages? You know, that kind of thing's always really interested me. So I wanted to start tweeting just little parts of my research that I was finding, things that made me laugh or I thought were interesting or things that were shocking. And to be honest, I didn't think that anyone would really be that interested in it apart from me. And it just kind of snowballed. And then before I knew where I was, I had several thousand followers. But it's the followers that make it, really. I mean, they're the ones that feed back to me all the time and give me information. And they send me pictures and they give me comments. And without them, it's just a woman in her 30s tweeting pictures of willies. It's just...
There are a number of very, very old dildos. Which tickles me. You know, it's like, I feel like we think of dildos as being somewhat new, but like pictures of like carved dildos and stone dildos from hundreds of years ago.
Not, like the oldest one that we found, I didn't find it, but the oldest one that has been found was in Germany, and it's 28,000 years old. Oh. And it's this big stone phallus thing. And the best bit about that is when people, like the archaeologists and the historians, are not quite sure what it is. And in the early days, they say things like, it's a phallic-shaped tool, before they finally just go, no, do you know what this is? This is a dildo. We're just going to call it a dildo. Someone just calls it and just goes, no, this isn't a tool.
We're not stirring our soup with this. Yeah. We're actually using it somewhere else.
A bunch of people sat around going, it could be a coat hanger. Does it look like a coat hanger to you? No.
So how are you finding all of these images? I mean, some of the images that you post are just stunning, and they're also diverse. I mean, there's pictures from like the Roman ages and pictures through the 1800s and 1900s. And I mean, some beautiful nudes in the 20s. I mean, how are you finding all of these?
Well, there is a very nice chap who runs an archive called Delta of Venus. .com, and he has got a huge archive of vintage pornography, and he very kindly lets me have access to it as long as I give him a shout out whenever I'm using some of his images. So he's incredibly useful. The Roman images, the frescoes and the pictures from Pompeii and all those kind of things, they're all available with various archives online. Wikicommons is a good one because they're all in the public domain. as well. I'm very careful with the images that I tweet pictures of, because I'm always aware of copyright, which is a nightmare. But most of them are so old that they're outside of copyright. And then people send me pictures, which is extremely kind and very humbling. And I buy pictures. I buy vintage nudes and erotica from eBay, of all places. There's like all kinds of collections that you can go and see, and there's a few archives online. So it's just a case of knowing where to look for them, really.
The images that you post are just so fascinating. And one of the things that it just really highlighted for me, as I've been following you for the past couple of months or so, is, I mean, there's pictures from medieval times with like trees full of penises.
Ah, the penis tree.
And yes, the penis tree. And, you know, there's pictures of women walking with geese who actually don't have geese heads. They have penis heads.
Yes.
So it's fascinating to me that there's these very sexual images of like genitals and erotic art that's just really been happening for centuries and centuries and centuries. And I think oftentimes we think of so much of our sexuality, specifically like BDSM, as being fairly new. And in fact, I mean, there's pictures that I've seen on your feed of people being bent over and spanked from, you know, many hundreds of years ago.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, the thing about any kind of history of kink or the history of sex work or anything like that is it tends to be shrouded in secrecy. So finding its history can be tricky, but it's certainly there. I mean, BDSM has a very long history. There's been Roman frescoes of sort of spanking scenes found that are thousands of years old. The Victorians were hugely into flagellation. It was known as the English vice at one point, one of our many gifts to the world.
That and tea, perfect.
That and tea. What more do you need? Absolutely. Cup of tea and a spank and we're all done.
That's right.
Oh, but yeah, like, and there's the spanking was big in the 19th century. It's in so much of the written pornography and the photograph pornography. And I find that quite comforting, actually, just to see it, that we've always had a kinky side to us. This isn't new. It's not something that we've just come up with. It's always been there. But what's happening is that it's more open. We're more able to discuss it. It's in a more public forum than perhaps it's ever been allowed to be before, which might be why we think it's new, but it's not.
And I also just like how that helps to shift the dialogue around this idea that BDSM is some type of like mental illness or perversion, which thankfully we're moving away from now in like mental health circles. But to know that this has been a part of the erotic experience for centuries and eons, you know, I think really helps to just reinforce the fact that like this is a normal part of the way so many of us experience our bodies and pleasure and sex.
Yeah, like there's this idea that we have normal sex and then we have these bizarre deviations and perversions from it. I think that's something that really needs dismantling, because human sexuality is infinitely varied. It's infinitely enjoyable, and it always has been. That's the other thing too. It's, if you like, you read through the history of it and you realize that this is just part of who we are. This is just part of the human experience, is enjoying sex and experimenting with sex and having psychosexual development. And I think it's something that's uniquely human as well. I mean, I'd need to speak to a zoologist or someone, but I don't think there are wildebeest on the Serengeti asking each other to spank one another. Do you know what I mean?
That would be quite the development.
That really would be, wouldn't it? That would be headline news just in. But it's a really human thing, isn't it? It's this kind of real kink and playing with it and enjoying it. But it has a really long, really strong history, and a valuable one, because it teaches us that this isn't perverted or wrong. It's just part of who we are.
Well, and the same really goes, I think, with sex work and what your Twitter is demonstrating of just, you know, through all of the different waves of power and religion and expressions of, you know, humanity, there's always been the sex worker, or, you know, I know words that were used in past were things like prostitutes and whores, but there's always been this part of society that's at play and sometimes being talked about a little more openly than others. And then of course, all of the language that goes with sex work and some of the phrases that you share on the Instagram are just fantastic.
They're quite revealing, aren't they? I mean, you can tell a lot about how a culture views certain people or certain behaviors by the language that's used to surround it. I mean, for example, we talk about sex workers as being the oldest profession, but it isn't, actually. It's not at all. There's a number of indigenous societies, groups of people around the world that have no word for sex worker, whore, prostitute. It's just not in their vocabulary. For sex work to exist as a profession, you need to have commerce and you need to have money and you need to have the idea that you have a job for a living. And that's something that happened with civilization. So if you go back to like indigenous tribes, I think the Aborigines in Australia, they didn't have, there's no recorded instance of sex work amongst them. The native Hawaiians, when in the 19th century, when Christian missionaries came over from America to civilize the Hawaiians, they had to invent words to explain to them what adultery was or what sex work was, because it just didn't exist in their vocabulary. So they had to invent words to teach them this is wrong, which I find fascinating, because it just wasn't part of the idea of sexual shame, of that being wrong, that's a bad thing. They didn't compute that. That just wasn't part of their experience. I think that's really important.
That is fascinating.
Isn't it? Wow. Because that just shows you how fluid our attitudes to sex are, because it's so entrenched in us that good sex, bad sex, this is good, that's bad, this is wrong, and we're kind of moving away from this constant moralising of sex is bad, sex is bad. But it just goes to show that there are societies, and still are, I mean, certain hill tribes in Thailand, I can't remember the name of them, but they have no concept of sex work either, no words for it. There are islanders around the world who have no word for whore or any of that, because they don't see sex as being shameful, so why would you have a word to try and stigmatise someone because they're having sex? That kind of thing. So I think that this idea of sexual shame and stigmatising people seems to be something that the West have been particularly good at. So-called civilization. So, yeah, and I find that's fascinating. Right? Because if we look at that, we can understand that our attitudes to sex aren't set in stone, that they're part of an ongoing process, and they can be changed. And they can, we can move to a place where maybe one day we won't even understand shame around sex work. Maybe.
Yeah, I think that's so powerful in all of us understanding that the ideas that we often have about sex are not our own.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely.
They've been assigned to us and we've internalized them as our own, but they're not actually our own. It's just what everyone's told us we're supposed to believe or feel about sex.
Yeah, they're like inherited cultural units, almost, is that we get told that this is bad, this is wrong, this is this, or we just get taught how to behave sexually and then we inherit it and then we propagate it and we keep going with it. But these attitudes aren't set. They can be changed, they can be challenged, they can evolve, they can move back again. So that's hopeful, because that means that we're moving, hopefully, to a more inclusive and more understanding place.
So with all of the hundreds and hundreds of images that you've shared and all of the discussions that you've had with your very engaged audience, what are some of your either favorite things you've shared or favorite things you've learned since creating Whores of Yore?
Like I said, the followers, they teach me things all the time. They teach me things all the time. They call me on things very quickly if they think that I've overstepped the mark, or if I've... And the other thing that I've learned from Twitter pretty early on is that you're always going to offend somebody. And I try very, very hard to be... To not upset people. But then again, at the same time, you do have to hold on to what's important to you, because otherwise you're just going to end up with something that's so diluted by trying to please everybody that it's not going to happen. There's just always going to be some people out there that don't like seeing pictures of dicks. So you can't, and you can't do anything with that. So you've got to stay true to what's important to you. But the sex work community have been absolutely vital to the feed and to how I do research, actually. They've changed what I think about, how I want to engage with that particular subject. And it's made me even more passionate about the feed being a platform for their experience. And that's been something. And another issue that it's raised for me is, as an academic, as someone that researches sex work, is what sex worker rights needs really another milk-white academic speaking for them? So it's made me very conscious of that, to not ever exclude what's known as the authentic voice, their voice. Because they are a group of people that are misunderstood, they're misrepresented, and unfortunately they have very well-meaning people speaking for them, but perhaps not allowing them to speak for themselves. So that's something I want to challenge a lot. So they're really important, and getting their voice and getting their feedback and allowing them to direct the feed and speak to me and what's important to them and what do they want, and all of those things are vital to me. As for, do you know, one of the things that I love doing is at the end of the day, just before I go to bed, I always find a silly picture and I post it and I say captions. Captions, please. And it's probably my favourite time of the whole evening because they're so silly. The stuff that comes back, honestly, it has been stitches. It's brilliant. And I love retweeting that, and they're just very funny.
Yeah, I've noticed that a lot of your retweets are not only the captions that people weigh in on, which can be amazing.
They're so good, aren't they?
Yes, and it's really pointed out to me that, like, I may be good at a lot of things in life, but coming up with puns is definitely not one of them, because I'm so in awe of some of the things people come up with. Like, that is just not, my brain is not wired that way.
I agree. I'm exactly the same. They're just, there's some absolutely amazing ones. Yeah, fantastic.
Although some of yours are hysterical. I mean, one of them was a medieval piece of art with a man kind of uncloaking his penis, and your caption was "medieval filth," and like something about that just completely tickled me. And I love the discussions. I mean, the Daily Dot did an article on you, and they featured a little exchange that you had with a sex worker, in that you had tweeted out how sex workers in ancient Rome were to wear flame-colored togas.
Yes.
And in 13th century Marseille, they did a striped cloak, and in England, a striped hood.
That's right, yes.
And a sex worker had replied that in 21st century London, we wear Louboutin, Chanel bags, and smiles.
See, how could you not love that? That's so good.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's such a lovely way for this dialogue to be happening where, you know, that's not a threatening tweet.
No.
So someone reading that might be a little shocked and might be a little surprised, but here's a sex worker actually doing something that's a little tongue in cheek about, like, hey, we're all around you, and yes, this is what we look like.
Yeah.
And so now we have this voice that's amplified, but in a way that's not like booga booga scary sex worker.
And I think that's I really see a value of the feed in that. And like I said, I'm very conscious of the fact that I don't want to speak for sex workers again, because that would be a crap thing to do. But by allowing sex workers to, I say allowing, but hopefully sex workers engage with the feed, and I can retweet them, and then I can point followers in the direction of what concerns them. And I get messages all day, every day, about people saying that I've changed their view on sex work, that they didn't realise that it was the experience that it was. I actually changed my mum's view on sex work, which was, and not just her, but the whole of her Women's Institute group, who sit around each week and do crafts. It was brilliant. A sex worker who's now a stand-up comic called Miranda Kane. She does a stand-up show based on her experience as a sex worker. It's called Coin Operated Girl. And she gave me some tickets to come and see her, and I took my mum and all of her WI friends, who are just lovely but very beige, slightly elderly ladies who brought knitting to the thing. And then Miranda did this whole 20 minutes on face sitting and squirting. And having a nice time.
That's good for them.
That's just, did anybody want anything from the bar? Oh, God. But honestly, we left, and the whole way home, everybody in that car was going, she was so good. I had no idea, Kate. I didn't know. And they were all talking about how it had revolutionised the way that they think about sex work. And do you know why? Because she punctured that narrative of sex workers are abused, drug addict, trafficked, pimped out, all of those things, like everyone's shivering on street corners and beaten up every day. And when you start to dismantle that narrative, that's an extremely powerful thing. And I hope that that's what the feed does by, like, retweeting things that sex worker said about Louboutins. That's humanising, it's funny, but it's got a really serious point behind it, which is that, to me, that we're here.
And one of the other things that you're doing with Whores of Yore is because you are also sharing images of naked bodies from throughout eras and across the world, you've also gotten a lot of people who are saying that you're helping around like body shame and body positivity. Isn't that right?
Yes. Yeah, that wasn't something that I saw coming at all. And I'm thrilled. I'm really touched that it would have that reaction. But I think what it is that when you, firstly, you don't see old pornography that much. You just don't see very often pictures of Victorians buggering each other's with bottles, but they're there. But and like the thing that I find really powerful about these images is not only does it say, look, they were having sex and they were having fun, but the body shapes in them is, this is before silicon and before Brazilians and before airbrushing and Photoshop and size zero and all those things. And what you've got are just regular sized people with little pot bellies and a full fuzzy bush and hairy armpits and no makeup on, and they look beautiful. And not in like a kind of like a everyone's beautiful colour. They really do look beautiful and glamorous. And I had two messages this week. One from a girl telling me that she said that she has a daughter, and when her daughter gets to be old enough, she's going to show her the pictures of Whores of Yore because she wants her to see what women's bodies look like. Which I thought was,
oh, wow.
I thought that was such a lovely thing. And she said that she knows that sounds like a bizarre thing to say. You'd show your child pictures of porn, essentially, but she was making the point that her child's already seeing hypersexualized images of really distorted bodies. So she, like, and it was just the, she was focusing on like the little pot bellies and the cellulite and all those things. And it was just, that wasn't a reaction that I'd seen. But now, but when I thought about it, you don't see bodies that look like that in modern porn or modern magazines, do you?
Yeah.
So when you get a little belly and some fuzz and boobs that maybe aren't like two soccer balls stuck to your chest. that can be.
Yeah, just seeing that diversity is amazing.
I know, but like, so what's more frightening about it is that's just what a normal body looks like. But we've become so disconnected from it, so disconnected. You know, I've had classrooms full of students before, and we're talking about feminism and gender, and the issue of pubic hair fascinates me endlessly.
I love talking about pubic hair.
You know, and it's just like, I mean, like the idea should just be, look, whatever the hell you want to do with it, you do with it. I mean, you diet pink and stick macaroni pasta and sparkles on it, whatever you want. But like,
anyone does that, please send a picture.
Get a Mr. Potato Head. Whatever it is that you want to do with your pubic hair, do it. But I have been with rooms full of 18-year-old girls before, students, undergraduates, and they have said things like, pubic hair's disgusting. It's disgusting. Mm-hmm. And that's such a, like, you think about it, like, what, your body, your hair that grows naturally on your body is disgusting? Like, how do we get to that point? You know, well, like, it's actually regarded as something grotesque and something that makes them visibly shudder, and I just think that's really interesting. That, how do we get to that, you know? That fascinates me.
Right. And what's the next step? You know, I mean, if through the ages we've had different dialogues about the way our bodies are supposed to look, different amounts of underarm hair and pubic hair and the length of our hair and the ways that our bodies look, you know, imagine 100 years from now or 200 years from now, like, what will they be saying about the way we're groomed now, you know, and allowing space for us to realize, like, this is not the right way to do it. It's just the current way to do it. And it's going to change.
I like that. It's just current because you know what? It will change. It will change again. Pubic hairstyles have come and gone throughout history. The ancient Egyptians, both sexes just took everything off. There was no pubic hair at all, not on men either. You get pictures from very early Victorian ones where there's clearly hair removal going on. And then you get to, like, right up to the 1970s when it's just full bush. But now, this is just the current fashion that we've got. And I think, I could be wrong, but I think pubes are getting to make a bit of a comeback. I think Lady Gaga did something with pubic hair, did she? Or maybe I've just dreamed that. But yeah, this... I think
oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I think they're beginning to make a bit of a comeback, but I'm not sure. But yeah, fashions change, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, I think that when you watch, like, feminist ethical porn, you see a lot more pubic hair and a lot more different ways of styling or showing pubic hair. And I think that, you know, as those images become more popular, it starts shifting the dialogue a little bit. And so I think you're right that I think more people are starting to leave space. Like, I spent probably, I don't know, 10 or 15 years feeling like if I did have pubic hair, that people would find me gross.
Yeah.
You know, and that was like from 18 through like my late 20s probably. And like now, I mean, I haven't shaved my pubic hair in probably like 6 months and it's amazing.
Hurrah!
Right. You know, and like, it's a wonderful thing to like touch and play with and, you know, so allowing for that change and that shift in how I'm experiencing my body is a great thing. And hopefully everyone leaves space for that for themselves too.
Yeah. I think the idea, like with all of these things, it should be that it's just do whatever it is that you want to do, but don't ever feel that you have to do something. I mean, I just, it's the strangest thing because I don't remember anybody coming into the class when we were 15, 16 and saying, right, girls, everybody must take your pubic hair off immediately. So where did this, like, message come from? I'm always curious as to, like, why did we start doing it? Was it a boy that said that they didn't like it? I think that most of my partners would have just been quietly grateful, no matter how I presented it to them.
But yeah, exactly, right? It's like, well, we're getting naked, so accept whatever hair is down there or not.
I can't imagine any guy would get to that crucial point and then would go, well, I'm out.
I'm tapping out. Who's coming in?
Sorry. I was like, I can't work with this. I can't work in this situation.
I would love to know from you, one of my favorite things that you post is the horrors of your word of the day.
Yeah.
And some of them are spectacular and hysterical. I'm looking at one right now that's called Warming the Husband's Supper.
Oh, I loved that one.
Yeah, me that too. It's from the 19th century.
Yep. Yeah, it meant it was when a woman would lift up her skirts and she wouldn't be wearing any knickers because knickers were a 20th century invention. So she'd be pantless and she would lift up her skirt and she would warm her bottom and genitals at the fire. So it was the idea that you're warming your husband's supper, you're warming up your genitals on the fire. Which I love.
Which is amazing.
I think another one of my favourites was, I think it's the 18th century, and it was sneezing in the cabbage. And that was for oral sex on a woman, cunnilingus. And I just adored that one. What is that? Sneezing in the cabbage.
Oh, I'm going to have to start using that.
I hope dearly that people do. I hope that, like, someone somewhere, just one person, has said to a lover, do you want to sneeze in my cabbage?
Yeah, one of the other ones you have is poodle sap.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's a vagina, isn't it? That's 18th century as well.
Yeah, the statement you have for it's amazing. I must make an appointment with the waxer, Patricia. My poodle sack has become feral.
they're just amazing, though. I love looking at slang because, like, it just shows that we've always thought it was funny as well. Mm-hmm. Do you mean, like, it doesn't have to, like, just so serious all the time, you know? And that we have thought that these things are funny. I really like my word of the day from yesterday, actually. I don't know. Did you have the expression in America that, like, we say something is cobblers? They do it in the, like, we say, oh, cobblers. It's sort of like the equivalent of saying, oh, dumb, or no, like, oh, balls, or bullshit, basically.
We definitely have, like, balls, yeah. Bullshit, that kind of stuff, yeah.
Well, cobblers, it turns out, is 19th century Cockney rhyming slang, and it means bollocks, it means testicles, and it comes from cobblers, alls, balls. But in the UK, cobblers is, like, quite a polite expression of, like, oh, phooey. And it turns out that every time you're saying it, you're actually saying, oh, testicles. I love that.
How wonderful to be able to find these words and how they were used and then point them towards more modern uses of language. Yes. And being able to say, well, that's actually where that came from.
Yes, I love that. Well, someone told me that avocado actually means testicle, which I really liked as well. I thought that was brilliant.
Oh, that is wonderful.
Yeah. So I thought that was... But I love that, like, tracing back word origins. I think that's absolutely fascinating. Like, pornography, that literally means the writing of prostitutes or written by harlots. That's what that means.
Oh, from its, like, Latin, I did not know,
yeah,
that.
Yeah, graphia, as in written, and porna, prostitute or sex worker, harlot, written by harlots.
Wow.
Yeah.
See, we're all learning something powerful because we all consume pornography, but now we know where that word comes from.
Now you know, absolutely. But yeah, I think the words of the day are definitely one of my favourites because they're just so silly. They're just, and quite powerful as well. Slang's powerful.
Yeah.
It's funny.
Yeah, because a lot of what's coming through in the words that you share is because you can see that the time period that they come from, like the 18th or the 19th centuries, and even a few of them from like the 15th and the 16th centuries, it seems to really speak to how people are feeling about sex work and genitals at that time.
Yes. Yeah, it really does, doesn't it? And there's some really gross ones. I'm just sort of trying to think about now. There's duck butter from the early 20th century that meant semen. Just duck butter. Ugh. Oh, and so I'm just...
Yeah, that brings a very, very specific visual to mind.
Doesn't it? Yeah. That's just lovely. Oh, and another from the 18th century was a window pie, which means a woman that's had sex outside of marriage. And the reason that she's called a window pie is because if you left a pie on the window, someone would steal a piece. So they were like likening her to a pie that's had a bit stolen before it was eaten by the proper owner.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fascinating. Yeah. Yeah, I noticed something that you had tweeted early in October was from Theodore of Canterbury, which I think was around 690
AD.
And he had written what he thought about where semen should or should not go. And it says, whoever ejaculates seed into the mouth, that is the worst evil.
It's the worst.
From someone, it was judged that they repent this up to the end of their lives. So don't come in someone's mouth, because apparently that's the worst thing you can possibly do as a human.
You know, I agree with Theodore that, like, if you don't give someone warning and then you come in their mouth, that's really bad manners. But
yes.
I don't think that that's what he meant. He was he's an Irish priest, and that verse is written by a series that was written. They were written all across Europe, and they were called penitentials, and they were basically priest handbooks for sins that their flock, their parishioners, would confess to them, and how much penance they would have to give that person. So it was almost like a sin index. So if somebody would go to Theodore and confess, someone's come in my mouth, then he could look up his little sin book and go, ah, right, yes, sorry, no, you're damned for the rest of your life.
That one's particularly bad, but for murder, you know, you just have to do this 20 times.
You would be surprised what gets ranked above murder in some of these. And some of them, you're reading through it and thinking, did someone actually... that must have happened for that person to come up with a penitent for it. There was a guy called, what was he called? He's called Bishop Birchwald, I think. And he was, I think he's German. But he writes this, he says, have you done what some women have done and made a phallus from bread? And then he talks about, like, they're basically making bread strap-ons and having sex with other women with them.
Wow.
Yeah, so like, and that's medieval stuff. So that must have happened often enough for Bishop Birchwald to come up with that. Who's been making strap-ons from bread again?
I have to say, I've fucked myself with a lot of bizarre objects, but bread has never occurred to me, so I'm impressed by that.
I love that. But I don't think, like, we're talking about a loaf of Mighty White. I think that...
Yes. A nice solid crusty bread from the
hearth. Yeah, something quite sturdy, I think. But that's just reminded me, though, there was this medieval tradition of something called cockle bread. I don't know if you've heard of that one. Cockle bread was... so, like, you get all these sort of superstitious beliefs, and we still do them, like, you know, a little bit. Like, if you look into a mirror at midnight and say something five times, and you'll see the person that you're going to marry and all that kind of stuff. But cockle bread was a young girl, or a woman, I suppose, if she fancied somebody and she wanted him to love her back, she would knead bread with her vagina between her legs, and then she would bake it, and then she would give it to him, and then he would eat it and be consumed with lust. And that's cockle bread. And there was, like, a little song and a dance that's recorded as going with it as well, where these girls would get up on the table and lift their skirts way above their head and sort of dance around, and then sitting on piles of dough and just, oh my, you're just reading it going, wow. Wow.
That is impressive.
Yeah. So there's a tip for you, that if anybody gives you a piece of homemade bread that looks suspiciously like a vulva with some hair,
you know what is about
in the
to
top. Absolutely. You just watch yourself. Made vagina bread for you.
There's just, like, so much about this. I mean, I just want everyone to go check out everything that you post, because it's right now I'm looking at a picture that's attributed to Peter Fendi from 1835.
Oh, where the woman pissing in men's cups and they're drinking it.
Yes. Yeah, it's all of these, like, well-dressed gentlemen with their hard cocks out on the table. Yep. There's, like, six of them. And she's standing in there with her dress up on top of the table, peeing into their mugs, and they're all, like, cheersing each other. And it's this, like, it looks like this big, huge feast that they're all enjoying.
Yeah.
And it's just fascinating to me. I mean, you know, that here is an artist who thought that this, I mean, who knows, maybe he experienced this act, but here's someone who's, you know, using their urine in a very sexual way, and these men are loving it, and they're all hard and turned on, and I mean, it's just, we definitely did not invent anything.
No, do you know what, I struggle to find something that, like, maybe apart from sexting, but that's only because they didn't have the technology. It's whatever technology that we come up with, I don't think us finding a way to use it sexually is far behind that. In fact, I think the first porn film was released less than a year after the first actual film. So I just don't think that we've invented anything new. People have always been turned on by pee. There's loads of great Victorian pictures of women pissing all over everything.
Do you think there's a chance that it's squirting and they just didn't know what it was, so they depicted it as urine?
No, because I think that they know what squirting is. They know what squirting was. They know what ejaculate is. At least that you get, it's recorded in the Victorian erotic literature. I mean, you get a lot of misconceptions around things, but no, they're pretty damn clear when something is being pissed. They know whether or not female ejaculate was widely known, but it is referenced in Victorian pornography, so they at least knew what it was. But no, they certainly knew what peeing was and were quite keen on it, it would seem.
Oh my gosh. I'm so glad you started this Twitter, because the more I learn and the more I see, the more I want to know. And I love that you're doing all of this research. And I think so much of it, as entertaining as it is, it's also very educational in teaching us about the attitudes that we have around sex and where they perhaps come from.
I hope it is. What I want is that the content is it's humorous and it's accessible and it's interesting, but you do actually learn something. It's serving a purpose, you know, because it's important that we know our debates and where these things come from. Shall I tweet you a picture of some Victorian women peeing?
Oh my gosh,
you
yes.
want to see? Okay.
Yes.
Okay, this is just for you. Done.
I feel so special.
I hope I tweeted it to you. Otherwise, someone's going to get a real shock. When...
Oh, I got it. Oh, my God. That's spectacular.
Oh, look at that. Yes.
Okay, so everyone who listens needs to go and check out this at Dawn Sarah yeah. that Kate just tweeted. It's three women who are peeing, and it looks like they're suspending something with their pee.
It does, doesn't it? Now, I don't know. Yeah. They did have editing techniques, and they did have manipulating techniques, but I think that they're peeing in sync there.
Yeah. That's wonderful. And I love the little smiles.
Don't they look so happy?
Yeah, they like have bonnets on. They're grinning like, ha ha ha, we're peeing. And their legs are spread. And then they have like tons and tons of layers of clothing on.
They're like proper Victorian ladies, but they're just pissing on each other at the same time.
Oh, I love it. Oh, that's amazing.
It's just so, I don't know, I think that it's really important stuff. I mean, it is, it's an amazing image, but it's also loaded with so much history. And every time you see something like that, it punches this idea that sex is new, or that our ancestors weren't having sex, or that it wasn't enjoyable, or any of those things, you know?
Yeah. And it also, you know, I think that just culturally, we're all kind of raised to believe that our generation is the most forward-thinking, the most risque, the most outside the box, and that our parents would have no understanding of what it is we're actually doing, you know, or our grandparents. And considering the pictures that you tweet from folks that are in the 20s, the 30s, the 50s, 70s, you know, it's evident that literally throughout the course of, like, recorded history, people have been doing some, like, really kinky shit.
Yeah.
And, you know, we're not the most, like, sexually, I don't know, advanced generation, just because we happen to be doing all of these sexual things that we didn't hear about or see. You know, it's been around. I mean, there's this beautiful picture of these three amazing women pissing. I mean, that's great.
It is great to know that kink has always been there. But I think that, yeah, it's important to know that the sexual revolution, the 1960s is not ground zero for sexual revolution, but what I think is important about sort of our generation and where we're going is that it's much more public now.
Yes.
That I can even have a Twitter account and tweet that to the public is quite amazing, because that certainly wouldn't have been a widely circulated image. That would have been very hush-hush. You would have either commissioned that, or you'd have been very rich to have got it, or you would have bought it in a specialist shop somewhere. You know, so, but the fact that we can talk about it, that we can have those dialogues, I think that's what makes us quite important.
Yeah.
I think. But we're not the most sexually liberated time period. The Romans, the Greeks had very different sexual attitudes to our own. I mean, if you can go to Pompeii and see these enormous erotic frescoes that were just on the walls of people's houses, like just the places where they would be eating with their families, and there's just huge sculptures of cocks. And that's just a completely different attitude to the one that we've got. And and like you mentioned about the women with the penis tree and those things, those images are from the margins of medieval manuscripts, are normally religious ones. They were done by monks, and no one knows why.
Wow.
Like we're kind of like always guessing of like what was the mindset of these particular people. So they would all just be sat round having their Sunday lunch with, you know, grandma and grandpa and all the rest of it. There's just a giant dick on the wall. And what did they think about that? And our like best guess is just that it just would not have shocked them. It was just part of their life. It wouldn't have occurred to them that that was an offensive image, because we've made it offensive, you know?
Yeah. So I know that some of your current research now that you're working on is around sexual violence in contemporary culture. Mm. And I'd love to hear a little bit more about that, because I think you're so right in that the way that our contemporary culture views and talks about sex and bodies and violence is a really important story to tell. And so I'd love to hear about some of the research you're doing.
But some of the research that I'm doing at the moment is I'm really interested in the way that history is used as sort of like a setting for contemporary film cinema. If we take something like Game of Thrones, for example, which I love, by the way, but that has extremely high levels of sexual violence, of graphic sex scenes, of violence in general. And I've been doing a lot of research with younger audience members, and it seems that the number one reason and justification for that, for those levels of sexual violence, is it's medieval, that it's somehow historically accurate. And then I was really interested in that, and then I started to see more and more medieval type shows, medieval films, or just historical dramas, and the levels of sexual violence in them are always very high. So it's just very interesting to me that we have recast our own history as a time of sexual barbarism, and we now are exploring perhaps our own fetish for sexual violence by dressing it up in chainmail and giving it a sword and excusing it by going, oh, the Vikings were just like that. Do you know what I mean? Is,
yeah.
We don't have any... I mean, take, for example, the Vikings, yeah? The phrase that always goes with them is rape and pillage. Rape and pillage, yeah. Rape and pillage. We have got no evidence that that happened. We've got nothing. We've got diddly squat. What we've got is the record of a few nuns in Britain who were so scared that the Vikings were going to come over and rape them that they slit their noses to make themselves less sexually attractive. But we don't...
Wow.
Yeah, it's quite a stance, right? But we don't have any contemporary accounts from the Vikings. There's no Viking diary that's been found that says, got up at 7, raped, pillaged, then had tea. There's nothing. So all that whole image, rape and pillage, is a completely modern construction that we have attached to the Vikings. We don't know that that's what they were like. It's a myth that we've created around them. And I'm really interested in why that's happened, why we've done that, what this image of this barbaric, hyper-masculine, raping and pillaging Viking, and conversely, the threatened and endangered wench, and, you know, that what purpose do those roles serve? Why are they there? What does it say about us that we need that? I think that's really interesting.
I love that question of what does that say about us that we need or crave those images. And, you know, the first thing that comes into mind is finding ways to like reinforce our ideas of masculinity, specifically within like toxic masculinity. And that's really interesting. I hope you're going to publish a paper about what you find.
Well, I'm in the process at the moment of analysing data that I've been taking from it and trying to work out what audiences see when they see that. And the idea that, like you said, that it's reinforcing this idea of what's called in psychologists and sociologists hypermasculinity, otherwise known as toxic masculinity, that comes through quite strongly, that this is some kind of marker of what real men do. You know, that they take what they want, that they're violent, that this kind of sexual domination is just part of what makes them manly men. And that's really interesting. And I've talked to the students about it a lot because we do a couple of modules on Game of Thrones and on medievalism. And they always have some very interesting ideas. And sort of one of the things that they thought might be happening is that we live in a very politically correct society where there's nowhere to explore that, and perhaps by setting something in the medieval period or in the past, it gives you a license to be aggressive and to explore that.
Ah, that's interesting. So it's almost like taking the rape fantasies that so many of us have inside of ourselves and that maybe we see play out in pornography, but then twisting it just enough that it's consumable for mainstream.
That's it, yeah.
Ah,
is
interesting.
That we because then we're removed from it. We're like one step removed from it. We don't have to question the legitimacy of it. We don't have to question why is there so much rape in this? Because we've already told ourselves that there was just loads of rape in the Middle Ages. This is what happened. You know, so we don't... It gives it some kind of legitimacy, but really what it's doing is it's feeding our own fantasies and our own desires.
So what have you found to actually be the truth around, like, I've seen images of, like, child brides being married off to kings and things like that, but what have you found is actually in the evidence of the art and the writing of medieval times around, like, would it have even been called rape?
Well, it's a difficult subject to research, because the primary evidence that's left to us, there isn't a lot of it, and what there is tends to be in church records, ecclesiastical courts, those kind of things. So rape, like, even now, is a terribly under-reported crime, certainly under punished, and all those things that, like, and cast that back into the past when the judicial system was even worse. So the few cases that we've got will be but a handful of what was actually going on. But they did, of course, knew that rape was wrong. You get that all the way through. There isn't a society I'm aware of that it's ever said, no, rape's fine, you help yourself. It's always been bad, but what constitutes rape has shifted quite dramatically. For example, your average 14th century person wouldn't have had any understanding of rape within marriage, really. Like, it would have been the idea, because that was only made illegal even in Britain, and I think it was like 1990, marital rape. There wouldn't have been any understanding of that. If rape carried certain penalties, normally you had to pay money to the father of the woman who was raped, because it was regarded as a property crime. You damaged his property.
Wow.
Yeah, it's not a nice history. But there are different prices recorded for different women. For example, a virgin of noble birth, you would have to pay a heavier fine than if you raped a peasant, or if you raped a wife, or any of those things. So they certainly understood that rape was wrong, but what constituted rape to them was largely young virgins dragged off the street in the middle of the night, which is not that different from what we have today, I don't think, now thinking about it.
Oh, yeah. I totally agree. We have not come that far when we look at anything.
When we start looking at it, no, I don't think we have. But then you've got things like in the 18th century, rape trials were recorded, written down, and sold in leather-bound books as pornographic material. You can buy very expensive copies of the rape trials. So knowing that that would happen, the lawyers would deliberately extract as much gruesome detail from the victim as they possibly can.
Wow.
Yeah, I know. So it's really extremely cruel. Extremely cruel. But one thing that we probably can say is that the levels of sexual violence in the Middle Ages were not as high as they are depicted in Game of Thrones, where every named female character, give or take one or maybe two, is either subject to or threatened with sexual violence at some point. I mean, sexual violence in the Middle Ages wasn't like that. It wasn't like you couldn't walk from one end of the street to the other without, oh, I've been raped again. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, so, and of course they had moral compasses, and you couldn't just go around raping people. And rapists were punished by death at some points in history. Castration, exile, imprisonment, branding, all those things. So it certainly wasn't a you help yourself sunshine. But it's very, very difficult. But there is a serious disconnect between historical fact and public opinion.
Yeah, I have to say that when you said that, my first thought was like, wow, I'm definitely, up until this conversation, my assumption has been that the depictions I've seen in mainstream media and Hollywood were historically accurate, or at least based in some fact.
We all do, but but the honest truth of it, especially with something like the Vikings, is that we just don't know. We just don't know what their attitude to sexual violence was. We can make educated guesses on the scant material that we've got, but as for this idea that there were marauding hordes attacking wenches, and there's very little evidence for that either way. But that's what really interests me, is that disconnect between fact and what we like to believe, the stories that we've created, and what that serves, why do we like to think about the Vikings as these big, burly men raping and pillaging?
Well, I hope when you finish going through all of your research and you publish something that you'll share it with me, because I would love to make sure that I share that with all the listeners, because I am sure I'm not the only one who's completely fascinated and wants to know more now.
Oh, I'd love to. Happy to. Yeah, absolutely. It's something that I find really, really interesting, is that we rewrite the past to be heavily eroticized by our own standards. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, we are at the end of our hour, and I would love it. We've mentioned it many times, but just in case anybody needs it, can you share with people how they can stay in touch with you online, your social media links, and or any other links you want to share?
Of course, yeah. You can get me at, obviously, at Whores of Yore by Twitter. My personal Twitter account is at LiteraturePeep. But I think if you just put in Kate Lister, I should come up. And then there's my university profile page. So if you go to leedstrinity.ac.uk, I'll come up there as well. And we can have a chat. I like chatting.
Well, I will have all of those links on sexgetsreal.com for this episode. Yeah, so I invite everyone to check it out and to click through and to follow Whores of Yore all over Twitter and Instagram. It's some of my favorite content when it comes up in my feed. And I just want to thank you, Kate, for coming on the show and sharing all of this. I literally want to change my profession just so that I can do all this stuff with you, because it sounds so fascinating.
Come to England with me and we'll drink tea and tweet pictures of willies. Oh, it'll be loads of fun.
Oh, that sounds like a dream day.
Oh, no, I'll come to you. We'll go to, it's hotter where you are. Yeah, let's do that.
Yeah, we can go somewhere with sunshine and we can just tweet pics of naked people.
Done.
And
then to Mexico. And, brilliant.
Yes. Perfect. Do it on a beach. And I want to thank all of our listeners who tuned in. I hope that you learned something, because I know I certainly did, and that you were entertained. And of course, if you do check out Whores of Yore on Twitter or Instagram, be sure to tweet or retweet your favorites, tweet them at me, share them with me via email so that we can get lots of sharing going on and get more attention to this amazing, amazing project that Kate has started. And until next week, this is Dawn Sarah. Bye.
Bye.